act because there is an important mobilization, especially from the youth, against the global security law. It's important to withdraw that law.
The march ended under the Eiffel Tower, the place where Cédric Chauviat was choked to death. Cédric Chauviat died with a knee or neck choke. As long as this method will not be forbidden by the French government, the impunity of police officers will continue. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
On the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iranian commander General Qasem Soleimani and his companions, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip came together to thank the general for his support in their struggle against the Israeli aggression.
The assassination of General Soleimani has not stopped Iran's support for the Palestinian cause. Our resistance will continue until the liberation of Al-Quds. The blood of General Soleimani will not go in vain. General Soleimani made a turning point in the history of the Palestinian cause.
Many Palestinian leaders and officials joined the mourners and expressed gratitude to Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated in a U.S. airstrike in Baghdad on January. Palestinians consider General Soleimani a symbol of resistance for all the oppressed Palestinians.
We stress that the resistance will continue till all Zionist plots are thwarted in the region. The path of General Soleimani will continue. His assassination has made us more determined to keep the resistance alive.
Palestinians stressed that they will follow in the footsteps of General Soleimani, who had a major role in supporting the Palestinian resistance in different fields and making a big difference in the balance of deterrence and rules with the Zionist regime.
General Soleimani was assassinated because he was supporting the resistance front. He always cared about Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and Palestinians. His assassination has made us more united in our fight against the occupation.
Similar gatherings were held in other parts of the region to commemorate the Iranian top commander.
Palestinians here consider General Soleimani a symbol of resistance. They say they will continue his path of struggling against the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Palestine and Jerusalem Al-Quds. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
New crimes are added to the Saudi-led coalition's record violations of international law following the death of 22 Yemeni prisoners and the coalition's presence in 2020, all due to torture and medical neglect.
Torture has become a regular thing for the Saudi coalition, and unfortunately, these crimes are being frequent and vary from year to year. This year, 22 prisoners were killed either under torture or medical and food neglect. So we believe that there is an intention to get rid of the prisoners.
The head of Yemen's National Committee for Prisoners Affairs confirms that the UAE keeps hundreds of prisoners in its presence in southern Yemen, despite its refusal to attend any negotiations, while the United Nations has promised to attend amid the humanitarian nature of the prisoners' issue.
The Emiratis are an essential part of this aggression, and they are on the ground and they have dozens of prisons in the lands they occupied here and in the Horn of Africa. We have asked the United Nations to bring the Emiratis for negotiations, but so far there is no response from them and we are still waiting.
2020 witnessed remarkable progress in the liberation of 1,087 prisoners of the Yemeni army and the popular committees, 670 of whom were freed through UN mediation and the rest through local exchange deals.
The Saudi coalition's violations of international humanitarian laws are not only against the prisoners, but against the entire people of Yemen, who are the victims of an ongoing war on their country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Tehran University has held a ceremony to mark the anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's Minister of Science and Technology, who was attending the ceremony, said that universities and academic centers have great capacities to keep the path of Qasem Soleimani alive by studying different aspects of his personality and beliefs.
General Qasem Soleimani was a great person. His personality had different aspects. I believe that academic centers should study his behaviors and personality. I think his lifestyle and beliefs serve as a good role model for all the youth of our country and the world. We have great capacities and potentials at universities and academic centers in this regard.
The event in Tehran came as people and officials attended a ceremony in the city of Kerman, the burial place of General Qasem Soleimani, to remember his lofty status 1 year after his martyrdom.
The martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani had a big impact on the minds of people, both because of his own personality and what happened after his martyrdom. Therefore, for a researcher and expert of social sciences, his martyrdom provides a wide range of topics to study.
General Soleimani, the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, and his trench mate Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis were assassinated along with their companions in a U.S. terror drone strike near Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020. Meanwhile, in response, the IRGC targeted the U.S. airbase of Ain al-Assad in Anbar province in western Iraq to retaliate the U.S. assassination of top Iranian anti-terror commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Moreover, according to Iranian officials, Tehran has filed a lawsuit against the U.S. for assassinating General Soleimani, and soon a court session will be held in Iran in this regard. Iranian officials believe that more than anything, the U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani has proved to the global public opinion that the U.S. administration is the leading sponsor of terrorism in the world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
In gratitude for their sacrifices in confronting America, Israel and the Ottomans in the region, Yemenis held an event to commemorate the first anniversary of the martyrdom of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and his companion Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in the presence of the Iranian ambassador and representatives of the Islamic Resistance Movement.
Today, we live on the martyrdom anniversary of the two leaders, Soleimani and al-Muhandis. Remember the positions of these two heroes to stand by the nation's causes. Haj Qasem Soleimani gave himself to Palestine and the resistance and was intransigent in front of the projects of the Zionist enemy through which it wants to break up the region.
The participants recalled the actions of the martyr Soleimani and how he terrified America and Israel, which thought by assassinating him to weaken the resistance forces, but contrary, it lit a fire that would not be extinguished until the liberation of Jerusalem al-Quds and the demise of global arrogance.
We commemorate the two great martyrs, Haj Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi Muhandis, who strived for God's cause and are loyal to God and did what they were required to do. God gave them wisdom and strength. They were great people, and we should follow their path.
The martyr Soleimani was an icon in the face of the Zionist entity and its projects. He played a great role in supporting the Palestinian resistance movement and stood by the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Forces in its battles with Daesh in Iraq.
Once again, Yemenis have taken a resolve to continue the legacy of General Qasem Soleimani in the face of years of aggression against the impoverished nation by Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies and their Western backers. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
People have gathered here in Kabul to pay respect to the bravery and the leading role of two significant figures against invading forces and foreign-backed terrorists, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Afghanistan's national hero, Ahmad Shah Massoud.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and our national hero, Ahmad Shah Massoud, were close friends and comrades in the region. Their sacrifices have not been fully highlighted yet, so we need to know them more than ever.
Given the fact that Afghanistan has been repeatedly invaded by some superpowers, mainly over the past two centuries, resistance is considered a familiar concept among the nation. Afghans have had some top resistance leaders like Ahmad Shah Massoud, a national hero who became the victim of a terrorist attack back in 2001. His characteristics are very much similar to that of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani in the eyes of Afghans.
The U.S. expected to remove the name of Qasem Soleimani from the minds of resisting nations by assassinating him. But contrary to those expectations, he became a popular hero, not only for Iranians, but also for all resistance nations across the world, just like Massoud.
Afghans and Iranians share many commonalities in terms of history, culture, religion, and security. Many people here in Afghanistan believe that one of the major similarities between these two nations is their resisting spirit against the invaders. This event in Afghanistan marks the memories of two well-known resistance leaders, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Afghanistan's national hero Ahmad Shah Massoud. This comes as Afghans themselves are suffering from terrorism and are seeking to follow the path of these two heroes. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The U.S. State Department has announced a flurry of deals, including $290 million in Boeing-made precision-guided bombs to Saudi Arabia, $65 million in drones and fighter jets to the UAE, $169 million in military equipment to Egypt, and $4 billion in helicopters to Kuwait. We have prepared an article for you in this regard, written by Kenny Stansil Ryder. This article is published under the heading Lame Duck Trump's West Asia Arms Bonanza continues with approval of $290 million weapons sales to Saudi regime. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Despite opposition from the public and some members of U.S. Congress, the Trump administration, in its waning days, is rushing through weapons sales to a handful of West Asian nations with records of human rights abuses, including Saudi Arabian regime, and the United Arab Emirates, whose U.S.-backed blockades and airstrikes have exacerbated civilian suffering and death in Yemen's ongoing war. The U.S. State Department announced a flurry of deals, including $290 million in Boeing-made precision-guided bombs to Saudi Arabia, $65 million in drones and fighter jets to the UAE, $169 million in military equipment to Egypt, and $4 billion in helicopters to Kuwait. President Trump's lame duck West Asia arms bonanza continues, said William Hartung, the director of the Arms and Security Program at the Center of International Policy. Selling more bombs to Saudi Arabia, given its history of indiscriminate airstrikes that have killed thousands of civilians in Yemen, should be a non-starter. While the actions of Saudi Arabia and UAE regimes have come under increased scrutiny as a result of the Saudi-led assault on Yemen, Hartung also encouraged Congress and Biden to review the sale of equipment to Egypt in light of its brutal and counterproductive counter-terror campaign in the Sinai, which has involved severe human rights abuses, the killing of innocent civilians, and the driving of thousands of families from their homes. As The Guardian reported, Joe Biden's transition team has complained that it is not being properly briefed by the Pentagon on ongoing military operations, as is customary for an incoming administration in the weeks preceding inauguration on January 20th. In an effort to impede the transfer of at least some weapons, the New York Center for Foreign Policy Affairs is reportedly planning to file a lawsuit against Secretary of State Mike Pompeo over the proposed deal with the UAE regime. The filing will claim the Trump administration has failed to meet the legal requirements of the Arms Export Control Act. For the deal to proceed, there must be a full rationale for the sale and consideration of the impact on U.S. security and world peace, the New Arab reported recently. The lawsuit also cites the UAE's actions in the Saudi-led air campaign in Yemen. Although the U.S. Senate in early December failed to block President Donald Trump's $23 billion weapons deal with the UAE regime, the lawsuit calls for an injunction to stop the sale. The Trump administration has attempted to justify selling arms to the UAE, The Guardian noted, by saying the weapons allow the country to deter increasing behavior and threats of other countries. According to a press release issued recently by Defense Security Cooperation Agency, the arms deal with Saudi Arabia will support U.S. foreign policy and national security objectives by helping to improve the security of a friendly country that continues to be an important force for political stability and economic growth in the West Asia region. Critics of the weapon sales, however, say the deals will worsen human rights violations and destabilize the West Asia region. As The Hill reported recently, the notice kicks off a 30-day clock during which lawmakers can block the sale if they choose to. If Congress can't block it, Hartung said, the Biden administration should do so when it takes office.
the debate.
Hello and welcome to the debate. I'm Behrouz Najafi. An affront to justice. That's how the UN has described President Trump's recent pardons for Blackwater mercenaries. Rights experts complain that a pardon for the four security contractors convicted of killing Iraqi civilians in 2007 undermines humanitarian law. UN experts have reminded the fact that based on the Geneva Convention, war criminals must be held accountable for their crimes even when acting as private security contractors. That's the topic of our debate show tonight. Stay with us for that. Now let's go to Washington, D.C. to our own correspondent, Dr. Colin Campbell. Colin, last week we were discussing the same issue from a different angle, and there was media blackout. The majority of mainstream U.S. media didn't mention this. So now the UN has taken it to a different level. It's now some kind of legal challenge. What about now?
That's right, and it looks like the media has picked up on it a little bit, really expressing outrage from some of the commentators that have remarked about the pardons that the president made for these contractors from Blackwater. As we understand, this was an egregious crime that was committed with the slaughter of innocent Iraqi civilians that were later the perpetrators of this crime now can walk free. So you have some media outlets, if they aren't just saying and stating what happened as a declarative, they're expressing outrage, anger, and just disbelief that these would be the people that the president has pardoned. Now, what is being looked at also is just the whole pardoning process. I think that the president has put a test on the whole system of who is pardoned and why. Usually it is for people who were not afforded equity in under the eyes of the law. Maybe there was a law that was misapplied, or maybe something that was done injudiciously, or something that was done a little bit too exacting or too draconian in method. Well, this time it seems that this was the president's privilege that he took to pardon people that he felt should be pardoned, or some people who were giving deference to the president. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why there are many people who are now questioning just the whole system of who is pardoned. Again, this is not the main story that is coming from U.S. media, but it is something that is being discussed, especially amongst those who are at liberty to discuss the topics of the day with a little bit more freedom in their rhetoric rather than just mm-hmm. stating the news of the day as a flat declarative.
Okay, thank you, Doc. Our own Colin Campbell in Washington, D.C. Now, joining me to discuss this a little bit and look at it from different angles, first will be former independent expert with the UN Human Rights Council, Alfred Desaires, out of Geneva. Good to have you with us, Alfred. Welcome to the show. And, you know, as you know, these security contractors took the lives of Iraqi civilians back in 2007. On what ground has President Trump pardoned them?
Well, we have a culture of impunity in the United States, and this is only one of many cases. Constitutionally, the president does have the authority to pardon criminals, except that in this case, basically, he's giving his blessing on murder, his blessing on a massive war crime. But it's not just the practice of granting pardons. It's also the consistent pattern of impunity for American soldiers who commit crimes and for private security companies whose members, and we had nearly 100,000 private security officials in Iraq at the time, and there were many other major crimes committed. It's not just this one in Nusra Square in 2007. I remember the crimes committed at the time of the rape of Fallujah, and we know the crimes committed in Guantanamo as a daily torture situation that has been repeatedly condemned by United Nations rapporteurs. And all of these persons involved in these crimes have enjoyed and continue enjoying impunity. As an American, I can say, not in my name. I mean, I find it egregious, I find it outrageous. Mm-hmm. But as Campbell just said, the mainstream media doesn't like to carry these stories. Mm-hmm. I recall when I was a young student at Harvard, that was during the Vietnam War, and there were all of these war crimes committed by American soldiers against the Vietnamese people, civilians, women, children. Very little made it to the press, and it was us, the activists, the students, who were protesting because we had heard about these things and we wanted to see accountability on the part of American soldiers. Who was tried? This insignificant Lieutenant William Calley, instead of trying General Maxwell Taylor, instead of holding the hires up accountable for the systematic crimes being committed in Vietnam, and for decades now, since the beginning of the so-called War on Terror, we've had a problem of so-called secret prisons, the problem of extraordinary renditions. Mm-hmm. And my colleague and rapporteur on human rights while combating terrorism, Ben Emerson, did a study on extraordinary renditions. And it turned out that 54 countries in the world participated in the extraordinary renditions. And countries like Poland, Romania, Egypt, etc., all participated in this completely illegal program of kidnapping and sending people to be tortured. I mean, we had special agreements with Egypt, and we sent people specifically to be tortured in Egypt. Wow. And of course, we continued the torture in Guantanamo, and as I said, in total impunity, because no one has ever been held accountable.
Okay. Now let me also invite Senior Ellis with Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, out of New York. Good to have you with us, sir. Ian, rights groups argue that allowing private security firms like Blackwater to operate with impunity in armed conflicts will embolden the states to circumvent their obligations under humanitarian law. Is that true?
Yes, quite clearly. I was present at the first, the negotiations that led to the signing of the UN, of the International Criminal Court. Mm-hmm. And I spoke to a lot of the State Department and US military analysts and lawyers who were involved. And their sincere thesis was that because the law only allowed for prosecution if the state concerned had failed, then it was okay. You know, Americans were protected because they said, we have the best military justice system in the world. I had memories of Milei, like our other interlocutor there, where you might remember it took something like 30 years for the pilot of the helicopter that stopped the massacre to be recognized by Bill Clinton. But Bill Clinton was the president at the time and was at least paying lip service when the treaty was signed. We know that the US couldn't ratify it because of Republican opposition. And it's on the basic same principle. The U.S. can never do any wrong. I mean, it's American exceptionalism to the max. First of all, the U.S. can do no wrong. And secondly, that anyone wearing a uniform must be supported, which we're seeing with police impunity, with military impunity. He shot somebody in full daylight who was unarmed, but he's a policeman doing his duty, so we must support him. It's that attitude that pervades the whole system. And it really has come out here because these people were, they were paid security guards. They were like the doorman in a nightclub. I mean, it's like giving the bouncer in a nightclub the option to kill people at will. And internationally, that's how it will be seen. This was a clear massacre. Not the only one, by the way. They haven't even tried to investigate the massacre in the square that WikiLeaks revealed, where a helicopter up in the air gunned down a Reuters camera crew and then gunned down the people who went to rescue them and give them medical aid. That hasn't even been investigated yet, let alone prosecuted. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is a whole level of impunity which needs examination. Of course, we know, in fact, that the people who leaked that, they are being persecuted by the government, but not the people who kept it secret, who did it, who ordered it, who provided the circumstances, empowered those people to go in and kill civilians. And it's bad for the US in every way, not just morally, but if you're going to be cynical, it means that their word is worth nothing when it comes to looking for war criminals abroad. Who would hand over somebody to the United States as a suspected war criminal, knowing the United States' partial record, where that they protect the guilty when it's theirs and persecute the innocent when they're foreigners?
Okay. Now back to Geneva. Alfred, UN rights experts are also warning that pardons and amnesties, I'm quoting them, open doors for future abuses when states use the service of private military and security companies for inherent state functions. Do you share the same opinion?
Well, I written that in some of my old reports to the Human Rights Council and to the General Assembly. Indeed, in the ontology of the state is to keep an army and to keep discipline in that army. The main problem with private security companies is that it's an attempt to outsource this ontological responsibility of the state. And there the so-called status of forces abroad agreements that essentially grant them total immunity in the countries where they're operating, in this case Iraq, on the assumption that if they commit a crime that they will be under in personam jurisdiction of United States courts, and that the military will actually investigate those allegations of war crimes, and that those responsible will be brought to justice. Well, here we have four individuals from Blackwater who were in fact brought to court and convicted back in 2014 for murder. Now, it is a disgrace for a country under the rule of law that it would be tolerated that a crime as egregious as this one would be subject to pardoning. But as Mr. Trump said, these were people who had a long history of service to our nation, and therefore they deserve being pardoned. Now, this is like a mafia boss saying, well, they're my boys. You know, my boys are good boys. And that, when I was a young student in high school in Chicago, I mean, I remember the kind of daily indoctrination, if you want. You know, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What does that mean? Is that we are indoctrinated in believing that we, Americans, are, by definition, the good guys. We're always the good guys. Our soldiers do not commit war crimes. Our private military security officers do not commit war crimes. Only the other side commits war crimes. And that's why what we need is universal jurisdiction.
Right.
So that countries, other than the United States, when an American official goes to, say, Switzerland, if he is, say, the Minister of Defense, and he comes to Switzerland, well, he has responsibility for all the war crimes that have been committed under his jurisdiction, right, if he has not ensured accountability. Mm-hmm. So universal jurisdiction is a concept that has to be played in.
Right. Now, Ian, in a statement announcing this controversial pardons just a few days ago, the White House said that the move was broadly supported by the public and also backed by a number of Republican lawmakers. Is that really the case?
Well, I'm fairly sure it was backed by a large number of Republican lawmakers because they're looking over their shoulders at the Trump supporters who will or won't vote for them. I mean, you know, if Adolf Hitler had the good sense to wear a GI's uniform, these people would all be supporting him, no problem. But on the other side, if they were putting when we're talking about the public. Is the public aware of it? That's the real problem. And I think my colleague here was making the point, the public is not aware of most of this stuff. Mm-hmm. If you ask them about Milei, it's not on their list of battles. If you ask them about Abu Ghraib, if you ask them about Guantanamo, this is not big on the mental horizon. It's an issue that's buried very thoroughly. If it's brought up at all by the media, it's very lightly. Because the media has exactly the same prejudices. Our guys are right, the other side are wrong. If our guys are wrong now and again, then we should cut them some slack because they're doing this for us after all. I mean, there is a cult of the uniform and the veteran here in the United States, which pervades everything. A veteran, a veteran can do no wrong. In fact, lots of veterans do wrong. And, you know, the whole point of people in uniform is you're training them to go abroad and kill people. Mm-hmm. And they often do it, excessively and with too much zeal. And so people do feel sympathy for them. You know, I've spoken, everyone calls the Second World War the finest war. I've spoken to many veterans who tell horrifying stories about what happened to prisoners who fell into their hands if they were inconvenient. And, but they're just ignored. People know about them, but the reality is obscured to preserve this overall vision that the United States is a city on a hill. It's not just the United States, of course. Lots of other countries. The British have never held responsible those who committed atrocities in Kenya or in South Yemen or in India, come to think of it, the other places where they're involved. The French have never come to terms with Algeria. So, you know, it's not a uniquely American problem,
right.
But it is because America is, the United States is the sort of founding partner of the United Nations, keeps saying, it's taking action to uphold international law. Its actions against Iran are wreathed in the obligations to under international law and order, and yet it completely flouts it whenever it suits them. And in this particular case, there were options. I mean, Donald Trump could have said, oh, well, look, these guys, they were young, they're in a terrible situation, so I'll exercise clemency. We'll commute their sentences. But he didn't. He said a pardon. And the pardon implies this is all right, that they are, in effect, judicially speaking, innocent.
Yeah. Alfred, you both talked about, Ian talked about global jurisdiction. The ICC, ICJ... I mean, the U.S. does not recognize, you know, these international tribunals. So we have had a long record of the U.S. doing things, similar things since the Korea War, the things that the U.S. did in Afghanistan, you know, the U.N. probe about it and all that. So is there a remedy to this exceptionalism, U.S. forces always being good guys, infallible, great, you know, guys who never do anything wrong?
Well, it's up to us Americans to make sure that our fellow Americans, shall we say, grow up and realize that exceptionalism is not the way forward. But we still live in this bubble, and we still believe that we are the good guys. And it took me decades, actually, to separate myself from that, to, say, jump over my own shadow, to think outside the box. Not everybody does that. Here you are in your comfort zone. But while we're talking about universal jurisdiction, I mean, this can be done, and actually it has occurred. Back years ago, 2007 or 2008, when Donald Rumsfeld went to a right-wing group to speak in Paris, he had to escape because there was a warrant for his arrest. And he left Paris, and he went into Germany and was flown back to the United States with a military plane. So you see that there is a possibility under international law to prosecute for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and under the Convention Against Torture, which the United States has ratified.
Right.
Under the Convention Against Torture, there is an obligation of the territorial state to arrest and try whatever person is within its jurisdiction, in its territory, like Donald Rumsfeld at that moment,
right,
who is accused of having committed torture. That is, not he personally, but he as the responsible minister whose soldiers committed torture in Guantanamo and elsewhere. Let me just say one point.
Okay, we have only a few seconds left.
Assange and Snowden, we demand absolutely, and we must demand as Americans, that the president grant pardon both to Julian Assange and to Edward Snowden, both of whom are human rights defenders.
Okay.
And they have done more for the world than many others, and I think that the campaign against Assange is disgraceful. My colleague Niels Meltzer, rapporteur on torture, has specifically written to Donald Trump and demanded a pardon for...
Okay, Alfred, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. We're out of time. Thank you very much for your comments. We had senior analyst with Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, out of New York, and former independent expert with the UN Human Rights Council, Alfred Desaias, out of Geneva. And your host, Behrouz Najafi.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. England will enter its toughest nationwide lockdown since March, with schools closed until mid-February, as Prime Minister Boris Johnson warned that the weeks ahead will be the hardest yet. As new figures put the United Kingdom on course to exceed 100,000 COVID-related deaths before the end of the month without urgent action, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson said once again that people must stay at home, with exercise limited to once a day. All non-essential shops were told to close from Monday night. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Jessica Elgott and Peter Walker. The piece is titled "England to Enter Toughest COVID Lockdown Since March." Stay with us for more of Jessica Elgott and Peter Walker's article. England will enter its toughest nationwide lockdown since March, with schools closed until mid-February, as Prime Minister Boris Johnson warned that the weeks ahead will be the hardest yet. As new figures put the United Kingdom on course to exceed 100,000 COVID-related deaths before the end of the month without urgent action, the Prime Minister said once again that people must stay at home, with exercise limited to once a day. All non-essential shops were told to close from Monday night. The lockdown will last for at least 7 weeks, with measures to be reviewed during half-term week. Any relaxation would not come into effect before 22nd of February. Just a day after urging millions of school pupils to return to the classroom, Boris Johnson announced all schools would switch to remote learning until the February half term, and GCSE and A-level exams were unlikely to go ahead as planned. The Prime Minister said parents would reasonably ask why we did not make this decision sooner, adding, "I completely understand the inconvenience and distress this late change will cause millions of parents and pupils up and down the country." In an 8 p.m. address to the nation, the Prime Minister said he hoped that 12.2 million of the most vulnerable in society, care home residents and staff, frontline healthcare workers and social care workers, all those over the age of 70 and the clinically extremely vulnerable, would get their first vaccinations by mid-February. The Vaccines Minister, Nadeem Zahawi, later said these four groups added up to 13.9 million people in England. The United Kingdom was entering the last phase of the struggle, Boris Johnson said, adding, "With every jab that goes into our arms, we are tilting the odds against COVID and in favour of the British people." The crackdown comes amid catastrophic figures for hospital admissions in England and warnings of a grim death toll by the end of the month. Prime Minister Boris Johnson said, on 4th of January, there were 26,626 COVID patients in hospital in England, up 30% from a week earlier. The peak of admissions in the first wave was 18,374 on 12th of April. The country is now 40% above that level. Across the United Kingdom, there were 80,664 positive tests on 29th of December, with the case rate three times higher than the start of December. There have been 91,453 deaths in the United Kingdom with COVID-19 on the death certificate or within 28 days of a positive test. Given the current trajectory, the United Kingdom could reach the grim milestone of 100,000 deaths before the end of the month, according to experts. On Monday, 4th of January, the United Kingdom's chief medical officers recommended that the COVID alert move to its highest level from Tier 4 to Tier 5, meaning there is a material risk of healthcare services being overwhelmed and necessitating extremely strict social distancing. "We are not confident that the National Health Service can handle a further sustained rise in cases, and without further action, there is a material risk of the NHS in several areas being overwhelmed over the next 21 days. The chief medical officers of the four nations said, whilst urging those who still need emergency care for other illnesses to seek treatment. Other UK leaders also announced new restrictions. All schools in Wales will be closed until at least 18th of January, while mainland Scotland will be placed in full lockdown from midnight on Monday, for the duration of January. Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, said it was no exaggeration to say that I'm more concerned about the situation we face now than I have been at any time since March last year. Northern Ireland also looks set for new curbs, with Arlene Foster, the First Minister of Northern Ireland, saying the region faces a very dire situation. In his address to the nation, Boris Johnson laid the blame for the third national lockdown squarely on a new, faster-spreading variant of the coronavirus, despite widespread ongoing criticism of the government's slowness to act. "There is no doubt that in fighting the old variant of the virus, our collective efforts were working and would have continued to work," Boris Johnson said. "But we now have a new variant of the virus. It has been both frustrating and alarming to see the speed with which this new variant is spreading." Even in the past 36 hours, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson had insisted that schools were safe to open in most areas of England. "There is no doubt in my mind that schools are safe," he told BBC's Andrew Moore on Sunday. However, the Prime Minister was unable to identify what he believed had changed since the preceding days, when most schools had been told to remain open, only saying in his address that schools were likely to act as vectors for transmission, causing the coronavirus to spread between households. Under the new lockdown, people in England will be ordered to stay at home from Tuesday and advised to leave only once a day for exercise. MPs are expected to vote the tough new measure into law from Wednesday, although businesses were advised to close from Monday night, 4th of January. Across the country, people must now leave home only for work, and only if it is impossible to work from home, and for essential food and medicine. Exercise with one other person from a different household is permitted, but the advice is to stay local and limit activity to just once a day. Other reasons to leave home will be limited to seeking medical care, fleeing the threat of harm, and providing essential care. All primary schools, all secondary schools and colleges will be closed apart from the children of key workers and vulnerable children. "We recognise that this will mean it is not possible or fair for all exams to go ahead this summer as normal," Boris Johnson said. The Education Secretary will work with Ofqual, the regulator, to put in place alternative arrangements. Nurseries, alternative provision and special schools will remain open, and existing rules for childcare support bubbles will continue. But students will not be able to return to university and will be expected to study online from their current residence until mid-February. In-person teaching can take place for a limited number of critical courses such as medicine. All non-essential retail and hospitality must close or remain closed. Restaurants and other premises will continue to offer deliveries or takeaways, but alcohol will no longer be permitted for takeaway or click and collect amid concerns about people congregating around bars. Places of worship can remain open and offer communal worship, subject to social distancing, as can playgrounds, but outdoor sports venues, tennis courts and golf courses must close. Outdoor team sports will not be permitted, but professional sports, including the Premier League, may continue.